be turning to John chapter 9, which is where we will begin this morning. As you remember, we have been talking about, we've been discussing the book of John overall. One of the last things we've been doing is talking about the I Ams of Jesus, and then also there were seven I Ams, and then the seven miracles that are also recorded in John. Last week we were able to do five of the miracles. We'll briefly talk about the other two. You'll notice that there is this week and next week, and then we are at the end of January, which happens to also be the time that I will stop teaching. So we will continue one more week, and then I believe Duane will pick up teaching after that. Now, with the two miracles that we have left, I'm not looking to spend a lot of time on these, because as we talked about the I Ams, if you remember in John chapter 10, the I Am there was, I am the door of the sheep, and I am the good shepherd. And we had gone back to chapter 9 and talked about the story found there. So I'll just briefly mention a little bit, and if anybody wants to add other comments, I'm not trying to stifle any conversation, but I'm also not looking to belabor something that we've already talked about some. If you remember in John chapter 9, well, actually just briefly mentioning the other miracles. We remember last week we talked about John 2, where Jesus turning the water into wine. We had the healing of the nobleman's son in John chapter 4. In John chapter 5 was the healing of the lame man. And then in 6 we had the feeding of the 5,000 and Jesus walking on the water. So we'd spent our time with those last week. As we pick up with John chapter 9, I'll just briefly mention the story. We have Jesus who comes by the pool here, and there is a blind man. Actually, the pool was back in the other miracle, wasn't it? Here, there's not necessarily a pool. But Jesus comes along and sees a blind man here who has been blind from birth. As he speaks to him, he also allows him to receive his sight by putting together a combination of spit and dirt, basically. He anointed the man's eyes then with clay, and the man could see. Of course, it was on the Sabbath, as Jesus had healed him here, and there was some confusion then among the Jews. I don't know if confusion is the right word. They just didn't want to give Jesus credit for this. And so they talked to the man, trying to find out who had healed him. They talked to the man's parents, and the parents had said, well, he's old enough. You can talk to him. And so they ended up putting him out of the synagogue, because this man knew it was Jesus who had healed him, and he believed on Jesus. So they put him out of the synagogue. Jesus came and spoke to him as well. And that's kind of the general idea of it. The reason, again, that we had mentioned it before was because in John chapter 10, Jesus goes on to compare the leaders of the Jews who were not giving Jesus credit. By not giving Jesus credit for performing this miracle and for the healing of a man, they were also not giving God credit. Jesus, of course, was from God, and they were discounting God by discounting Jesus. And they were not being good shepherds at all of the flock then. And in John chapter 10, he is basically, as he says, that I am the good shepherd, as he speaks about being the door of the sheep, speaks about the robbers and others who enter in and try to hurt the sheep, in a sense he was speaking of the leaders and the elders of the Jews and what they did. Again, this is a miracle that many of us are familiar with. I'm not looking to belabor it, but if you would like to make any comments on this, I'm also not looking to diminish it either. Any comments that anybody would like to make on the healing of the blind man here from John chapter 9? Again, these miracles were done to produce belief, and they did in many cases. And that's one of the reasons that the Jews, the leaders of the Jews especially, were so against them in many ways. We'll briefly also mention then, and if you want to come back to this one, you can, but also going to Christ and Lazarus in John chapter 11. This is, of course, the seventh miracle. We have spent a good amount of time with this because in John chapter 11,
In verse 25, Jesus says, I am the resurrection and the life. And when we were talking about the I am's then, we had set up this miracle fairly well. And when I say fairly well, I'm talking about taking some time with it. We know that Jesus found that as Mary and Martha had sent to him, that Lazarus was dead. Jesus had waited a couple of days before going. By the time he went, we know that Lazarus was dead. He spoke with Mary. He spoke with Martha. He went to the grave with them. Because of the condition of the people who were there and their grief, Jesus wept also. But also he was prepared all the way through. This was for his glory, in a sense, and to show the glory of God in that he could raise Lazarus from the dead. And so as they all went to the grave, we know that he had spoken the words, Lazarus, come forth. And Lazarus came out of the grave. He was still bound in with his grave clothes. He said to loose him, and he loosed him and let him go. Now in verse 45, we see that many of the Jews also which came to Mary and had seen the things which Jesus did, believed on him. And, you know, if we remember, in the second chapter, Jesus' first miracle, the turning of the water to wine, seemed to be kind of under the radar. Not too many people even knew that Jesus had performed this miracle. By the time we get to the last miracle here, many had seen it personally, and they believed. We know over the next few days, few weeks, the news continued to spread. And as people gathered to Jerusalem to prepare to participate in the Passover shortly thereafter, Jesus and what he had done was certainly spoken a lot about them. We know that as Jesus entered Jerusalem later in chapter 12, that he came on a donkey, and they, of course, put the branches in front of him. And he had a very triumphant entry into Jerusalem. All of that had to do with performing this miracle of raising Lazarus from the dead. On one hand, it produced great belief among many people, but it also made the leaders, we see in verse 53, from that day forth, they took counsel together to put him to death. So it was a great thing in that produced belief, but it also was a turning point in that it was very much on their mind after that to put him to death. Again, this miracle definitely would not be diminished, and I don't want to diminish it. If you want to make any comments on it, it's just that 2 or 3 weeks ago we had spent a decent amount of time with this particular miracle also. Any comments on either of these two? It definitely did. I mean, Lazarus was a walking example of what Jesus could do then. Other comments?
Not that it really has a lot with the miracle and things, but I guess I just kind of overlooked verse 51 where it talks about Caiaphas prophesied that Jesus would die for the Jewish people, and not only for the Jewish people, but for all of God's children. And it's just one of those things, I think, that shows God's power, that even people who didn't believe in him would prophesy about the things that were to come. He used other people who were not Christians.
He spoke words not realizing he was fulfilling prophecy in a sense, but he was. Right. Other questions, comments on any of these? I also want to leave time to discuss what we're going to next. And again, on any of these, if you want to come back, if there's any other comments, feel free. But what I'd like to do next is, if you'll remember, we have, beginning in John chapter 13, from John chapter 13 to John chapter 17, is Jesus, the night in which he was betrayed. So here he is in some of his, really in his interaction with his apostles for one of the last times. We know that Duane has made the comment several times about people's last messages. This is, in a sense, Jesus' last message to his apostles. which makes it one of his last messages to us too. And it's interesting how, again, there's several chapters here that record the things that Jesus did with his apostles on this night. Now, I'll just make a couple of brief comments about other things relating to this, and then we have this week and next, and I'll share with you where we'll go with these two. If you'll remember from this, 13 to 17, in chapter 14, Jesus had said, "I am the way, the truth, and the life." And we've spent time covering that. In John chapter 15, he had said, "I am the true vine. I am the vine and you are the branches." And we've spent time with that. So we've spent some time with some of the words that he's already spoken in these verses. We know one of the other major points that he made during these chapters is the idea that he would soon depart. But upon his departing, he would send the Comforter. He would send the Helper. The Helper, the Holy Spirit, who would guide them into all truth. And he made this comment two or three times. And so while the apostles, in a sense, at the time weren't necessarily fully aware that Jesus soon was to die, he was sharing this with them. He was telling of who was to come after him. And they were beginning. They may have had some form of a picture before that. Not that they didn't have any picture. But they were beginning to get more and more of the idea that Jesus was soon to leave. What I would like to cover today, and also next week then, is actually in John chapter 13, the very first thing that Jesus did in preparing for this last message, if you will, by washing the apostles' feet. We're going to spend some time with that, and then next week we're going to hit John chapter 17, where Jesus prays to his Father that he and the Father are one, that he and the apostles would be one, and that he and all, and he and the Father and the apostles and all disciples would be one as well. So next week we will talk about John 17. This week we're going to talk about John 13 and Jesus washing the apostles' feet. One of the reasons that this is so very important, I believe, is the idea, if you picture this, as Jesus is soon to leave then, has he been showing them that they needed to be a servant to other people? Yes. But I don't think they really had the picture of it yet, necessarily. We know that, and we'll get into this in a minute, they were disputing even this night who was the greatest among them. And that is totally counter to what Jesus is about to teach them. And so if we think of one of the great last messages that Jesus has left his apostles and us, it deals with the idea that while he was a teacher, he was their teacher, he was their Lord. Yes, that's what they knew him as. But he was also their servant. And that's something that became very important for them to see in terms of understanding it. Let's begin and just read a couple of the early verses with this and then establish some other things. "Now before the feast of the Passover, when Jesus knew that his hour was come, that he should depart out of this world unto the Father, having loved his own which were in the world, he loved them unto the end." And I'm reading from the Old King James, and here it says, "And supper being ended, the devil having now put into the heart of Judas Iscariot, Simon's son, to betray him." You know, it's interesting, and we'll get into this a little bit more later on. Here, this says supper being ended. There are several versions that seem to indicate that the supper was, it says, during the supper. And there's other things. And later we'll get into the kind of the timing. But I want to talk a little bit about one or two other things that help establish what's going to be going on here. If you would, you might turn to Luke 22. Because there's a couple of things here in Luke 22 which talk about the exact same night that help to establish what's going on here. While they talk about the same events or the same occasion, they cover different events, basically. In Luke 22, I'm just going to hit about four or five high points as far as what had happened. And then I do want to get into one brief story with this. We see in the first few verses, I'll just read my headings. The headings in my Bible in the first few verses of Luke 22 says that Judas agrees to betray Christ. So right before they had gathered here, whether it was that same day or a day or two before, but Judas had agreed with them that he was going to betray Christ. The upper room is prepared in verses 7 to 13. We have the Passover being celebrated, verses 14 to 18. We have the Lord's Supper being instituted, through here as well. Verses 19 and 20 in here. We have Christ predicting his betrayer in 21 to 23. So we're seeing what's going on in this upper room as the apostles are gathered with Jesus. But I think it's interesting also to notice, beginning in verse 24, and this very much is a part in setting up what it means when Jesus washes the apostles' feet to change their perspective about some things. My Bible, again, has a heading above verse 24 saying, the disciples argue who is the greatest. Would someone read 24? Let's see, we'll start with 24 and go ahead and go down to 30.
Now there was also a dispute among them as to which of them should be considered the greatest. And he said to them, the kings of the Gentiles exercise lordship over them, and those who exercise authority over them are called benefactors, but not so among you. On the contrary, he who is greatest among you, let him be as the younger, and he who governs as he who serves. For he who is greater, he who sits at the table, or he who serves? Is it not he who sits at the table? Yet I am among you as the one who serves. But you are those who have continued with me in my trials, and I bestow upon you a kingdom, just as my Father bestowed one on me, that you may eat and drink at my table in the kingdom and sit on the thrones, judging the 12 tribes of Israel.
All right, we'll stop there for now. And so to me, it's kind of ironic, if you will, that the same night that Jesus and his apostles are gathered together, these same men who have traveled with him for 3 years, what are they arguing over? Now, why do you have any idea why they may be arguing about who is most important? If you go and connect it, and I can't guarantee this, it's somewhat conjecture, but one of the traditions of the Jews was to wash each other's feet, especially as they were purified, as they were preparing to partake of the Passover, preparing to eat a meal together. It may have very well dealt with the idea of who do you think typically did wash the feet of those who were there?
Servants.
The servants. Okay, so the servants, the least of them, are the ones who wash the feet. It may be that the reason they were disputing this is to see who is actually going to be washing each other's feet. Again, that is somewhat conjecture, but I can see how it would easily go together.
Now, when you say servants, the apostles, a lot of them were just fishermen. I just can't imagine them having servants in their house to wash their feet.
They may not have had servants to wash their feet. But I don't know what their... They also may not have been used to washing each other's feet. They may not have been used... I mean, had Jesus already, in many ways, probably given the ideas and taught ideas about serving others? I'm sure he had. But had they really got that concept yet? Apparently not. Now, so while you're saying the apostles themselves did not have servants to wash their feet, and that's true, they also, and again, I can't guarantee this, but certainly we know that Jesus did wash their feet. Usually it seems like that there was a pit, I don't know, pitcher's not the right word, but whatever would be there to have the water in. That, I mean, it was a Jewish tradition. Many houses, I would think, especially in terms of purification, would have these things available. And so it may be that they knew that somebody was going to do it anyway. I don't know if they did or didn't. It was conjectured in one or two commentaries along those lines, and it does make sense, but I can't guarantee that. Okay? Comments on this piece of it?
I think possibly also they were looking forward to a kingdom, mm-hmm. probably earthly kingdom still at this time.
Yes.
They didn't understand quite. And so they were thinking, hey, you know, we're his lieutenants here. We're the ones that have stuck by him. What part are we going to have in this kingdom?
And, yes.
You know, we may be pretty high up where people will be bowing down to us. And the foot washing would come in as far as the humility and servitude.
Exactly. And just taking a couple of verses that Eric had read a minute ago as we prepare to go back to John 13. But Jesus does point out that when it comes to the traditional pattern, the kings of the Jews, there in verse 25, the kings they exercise lordship. They have the authority. But But for us, in verse 26, you shall not be like this. But the greatest is going to be as the younger, and he that is chief as he who serves. And Jesus, we're going to find, is the one who serves. And how does he end verse 27? I am among you as he who serves. Let's go ahead and come back then to John chapter 13. So we see the idea of the apostles and Jesus as they've come together. Now, it may be important to just make a point or two about the timing here, because I had mentioned earlier there in verse 2 it says, and supper being ended, at least the version I'm using. But many of you have, there's different versions among us right here. Let me look where I had put that those particular words. Let's see. So last evening. The idea, and I can find that in a second too, but the idea is whether the version I'm reading from says that supper was ended. Some versions say before supper. Some say during supper. But one particular version that was mentioned, the idea that conveyed was that the supper had been served, but they had not yet started to eat. So in a sense, the serving had ended, but they were all sitting there prepared to eat, but they hadn't started to eat.
13:2, I think.
Well, that's what I'm looking for, yes. But what I was looking for was my notes in terms of some of the different versions and what they said. I've basically summarized what they said. But again, and it may very well be this idea. Because as I read five or six different commentaries, all seem to indicate that really the phrasing of the King James Version, supper being ended, isn't the best translation of that. The idea in most of them was that whether the serving itself was done and they were now ready to eat. The point we're making with this then is that they were also preparing to be purified, if you will. I might come back to one other passage, if you go back a chapter or two. Back in John chapter 11, verse 55, as they came to Jerusalem to partake in the Passover, it says, and the Jews' Passover was near at hand, and many went out of the country up to Jerusalem before the Passover to purify themselves. There was a purifying that would take place before they took of the Passover. And right here, as they are preparing for this, that as Jesus prepared to wash their feet, there it was, in a sense, a purifying as well. So I don't want to diminish the idea of purifying, but it's also a matter of Jesus being a servant. Okay? And we see then in verse 3, Jesus knew that the Father had given all things into his hands, and he was come from God and he was going to God. He is now ready to return to his Father. So in verse 4, he rises from supper, and he laid aside the garments, and he took a towel, and he girded himself. After he had poured water in a basin and began to wash the disciples' feet, to wipe them with the towel wherewith he was girded, he came to Peter, and Peter said, Lord, don't wash my feet. And Jesus said, What I'm doing you don't know now, but you will know soon after. Peter said, you will never wash my feet. Jesus said, if I do not wash your feet, then you have no part with me. Peter said unto him, Lord, not only my feet, but also my hands and my head. Just reiterating and reminding us what this story so far has been about. As Jesus approached Peter, whether Peter was the first apostle to have his feet washed, or after three or four others, I don't know. But on one hand, he knew Jesus was much above him. Jesus, you're not going to wash my feet. That's what a servant does. You are the Lord. You're not going to wash my feet. But Jesus points out that is what his role is as well. And if I'm not going to wash your feet, then you don't have any part of me. And of course, Peter changes his tune very quickly. If that's going to be the case, then wash all of me. Well, Jesus makes the point as he goes on, to say in verse 10, basically you're already clean. He that is washed needs not to wash his feet, but is clean in every other way. And you are clean, but not all. So you're already clean. It's not as if I need to wash all of you, but we are washing your feet, both as a prep, as a purification, but also as a way to serve. Okay, of course in verse 11 when he says, or in verse 10, but you are not all clean. He also says it in verse 11, for he knew who should betray him, He said, "You are not all clean," talking there about Judas. Now, in the next few verses, he's going to describe what he's just done. So after he had washed their feet and had taken his garments and was set down again, he said unto them, "Know you not what I have done to you? You call me Master and Lord, and you say, well, for so I am. If I then, your Lord and your Master, have washed your feet, you also ought to wash one another's feet. For I have given you an example that you should do as I have done to you. Verily, verily, I say unto you, the servant is not greater than his Lord, nor he who is sent greater than he who sent him. If you know these things, happy are you if you do them. I speak not of all of you. I know whom I have chosen, but that the scripture may be fulfilled, he who eats bread with me has lifted up his heel against me." I'll go ahead and stop there for now. That's the main point with this. And so, as Jesus is washing his apostles' feet, this visual image of them seeing this was very different than Jesus telling them they needed to be a servant. Jesus could have told them many times that they needed to be a servant, and it wouldn't have sunk in as much as them seeing him do this. What were his words to them as he started? In verse 14, "If I then, your Lord and Master," well, back to verse 13, "you call me Master and Lord, and you say, well, for so I am." He is a master. He is, I shouldn't say a master, he is the master. He is the teacher. He is the Lord. He is the one who rules. He has a role, and that he has several roles, and two of those roles are as master and teacher. They knew that, but did they understand his role as a servant? Not at all, it seems like. Before, they didn't anyway. If Jesus had not done this, were the apostles as prepared to go out and serve others as they needed to be? This, again, is Jesus' last message. He begins his last message to his apostles by showing them what it means to be a servant. He who had been sent from God, and they knew that. They believed that he was from God. They knew that he was from out of this world, if you will. He was far above them. They had seen the miracles. They had believed from the beginning. But here is the one who would be the least likely to wash the feet then. But his attitude was very different. And he showed them that he was very willing to wash their feet, which means that he was very willing to serve in whatever capacity. One of the lowest of jobs, if you will, one of the lowest of roles was to wash another's feet. The servants did that. Jesus came to serve. You know, as we've been Christians over time, and we know this message, and this message seems, in general, imprinted in our minds by now, but in another sense, do we really have a feel for, do we fulfill this role the way that we should at times? This is something that Jesus taught his apostles at the time, but continues to teach us today too. The true importance of being a servant.
The last thing that he wanted them not to do is to follow the teachers of the Jews who had the exact opposite picture of what Jesus was trying to say. You know, they sat on a high place and they were the ones that were going to dole out, you know, what you're going to do and this and that. And they didn't leave a good picture at all of what God wanted his people to be like.
Right.
Kevin, you think... there, verse 10. Do you think that this is just Jesus pointing out a physical objective, or does this have some spiritual impact as well when he says, "He who is bathed only needs to wash his feet because he's clean already"? Do you think that's just, we're just supposed to take that purely as physical, or is there another meaning to that that we should be understanding?
Well, I believe that all of this does deal with purification to a degree as well. they were preparing to take of the Passover. There were purifying aspects that they needed to take that needed to take place. That's why I'd also read verse 55 of chapter 11. As the Jews did go to Jerusalem, it says they went out of the country up to Jerusalem before the Passover to purify themselves. Now, I don't know the exact pattern, but as Jews prepared to literally partake of the Passover, I don't know if they went through a ritual purification or not. But it seems to me that there is definitely an aspect of purification to this. But the point is, too, that they had already been purified in many ways, and all they needed to do to finish the purification would be to wash the feet. That's what, I mean, in a sense, he doesn't need to continue on and wash the rest of Peter. He's just finishing this part up. So, I mean, your question, I think definitely it relates to spiritual things, the purification. Do you have other aspects that you want to go ahead and mention?
I mean, if it does have some other spiritual meaning, you know, I'm trying to connect it to ourselves. And, you know, if we are purified, if we are bathed and clean in Christ, is there some other aspect, small aspect, that still needs to be cleaned? Or is it only Christ who can clean it? Or, I don't know.
I think you start with being purified when we're baptized. Does baptism itself wash away any dirt on our bodies? No, but the baptism, the washing of sins away by the water, our baptism is certainly a purification. As we prepare, of course, the connection with the Passover is Jesus as he became our Passover lamb. This morning, as we prepare to partake of the Lord's Supper, do we need to be purified in a sense as well? Do we need to try to have as little sin in our life as possible? Do we need to continue to be purified through forgiveness? Do we need, I mean, other connections that could be made here? Do we need to be baptized every time we sin? Not necessarily. We are purified already, but do we need to continue to pray? Do we need to continue to ask forgiveness for sins as they do occur? So here, you know, in general, we're already purified, but yet we need to, on a regular basis, continue to be purified by asking for forgiveness. So these are some of the spiritual connections that could be made today as well, I believe. Ben?
I've always just thought this was very simple in that here they're preparing, they're being cleansed. It's their feet. It was the process. And Peter asked for this additional thing. Well, not just my feet, but my hands and my head. And Jesus says that's not necessary. And I look at that as, you know, God has given us commandments, things that we can do to make ourselves clean. And that's all we have to do. Anything that someone else says you need to do that isn't, you know, we should be careful not to add to it. I guess that's how I view it. Is, you know, there's no additional requirements beyond what God has required. Even Peter himself said, "Well, my hands and my feet." No, that's not how it works. God said, Jesus said, "Just your feet. That's all you need." And so that's how I look at it. Not adding to the commandments of God.
Okay, but I think that might go along with what I think on verse 10. You know, maybe the first part may be literal, but I think definitely the last phrase is a spiritual phrase, because I think a lot of times we read that and say, he said that, you know, you don't need to only to wash your feet, but because you're completely clean. But he said, you are clean, but not all of you. Now, he's not saying, Peter, there's some part of you that's still dirty. But all of you, and we take that in context with 11, is that he knew who would betray him, so he's talking about the other disciples, and the other one was Judas.
Right.
So I don't think he was talking about Peter. No, well, you know, you're clean, but you do have, you know, your hands dirty, or you got a smudge on your face. I don't think he's saying that.
Correct.
I think he's saying, but not all of you apostles are clean.
Right.
And then he goes right ahead and talks about who would betray him.
And there would be not of a clean heart, in essence. Other comments, thoughts in relation to verse 10 or other aspects with this?
See a lot today in society, and that's rewarding what you're supposed to do anyhow. Rewards are supposed to be for something extraordinary, something exceptional, not what is expected of you or what your duty is, just like this. But, you know, and we see this a lot with children. With, you know, we're told now by educators and whoever, people that think they know it all, that you should reward, everyone's a winner, and no matter what you do, you know, get a trophy. That's not what this passage teaches. If you know, if that's what we teach one another, then mediocrity is all well attained.
I can appreciate your point.
Going along with that point, just one more. In John, the fifth chapter in verse 3, he was talking to his disciples. And he said, "You are already clean because of the word which I have spoken to you." And they were clean, except one.
Right.
That was.
So with this, the importance of this and the value of this, not only for his apostles, but for us. As we're seeing here, as we're calling this, in a sense, some of Jesus' last words, here in the 13th chapter of John, we are seeing the importance being driven home of being a servant. I appreciate Eddie using the word humility. I had not yet used the word, but that's truly what this is about too. The humility of Jesus. Yes, he had come from the Father, and he was their Lord and their master and their teacher. But he also was their servant. He is our Savior, but he is also our servant. This is something that we also need to always take with us, not only the value of Jesus being a servant, but whether we have a low role, and at times in life we will have lower roles, at times we will have, quote, higher roles, higher authority. But as elders now realize, I believe all to become an elder, we realize the scripture, and while that is a high office in a sense, it is also an office of a servant. And that is the great value. Whether we are a Christian, whether we have other roles within the church as a deacon, as an elder, whatever it may be, we are also servants. Servants of one another. Servants of our fellow man, and servants of the Lord. Additional comments or thoughts as we close. We'll go ahead and take a brief break.